Tonight's lecture is called The Myth of the Aryan, Identity Politics, East and West, and I feel very proud to be able to present to you tonight our scholar, Dr. Dorothy M. Figuera. She is a professor of comparative literature at the University of Georgia, also the editor of The Comparatist and vice president of the International Comparative Literature Association. Her specialization is European languages and literature and Indian literature, with an ability in Sanskrit. And what makes tonight so special, in my view, is that it seems likely to me that most present-day speakers of English, and probably many other languages too, have specific associations with the concept of the Aryan. And no doubt, many of us will immediately imagine that this term has some relation to, for example, the Nazi regime. Few of us, however, have, I would assume, the possibility or maybe even the capability of doing research on the development of this concept, the concept that is behind the Aryan, especially in both the Indian and also in the European context. Dr. Figuera has researched notions of this seemingly culturally specific racial type, and her expertise in the various languages and traditions in which it has played a role makes it possible for people like us here tonight to come to terms, so to speak, with this troublesome term, the Aryan. I suspect that her talk tonight will invite us to consider what associations with the Aryan may still be alive in our culture here today, and challenge us to weigh our own views of what an Aryan is, or might be, against the various usages the term has had throughout history.
Thank you so much. This is a real pleasure to come here, come back to the Midwest after a few years of absence. I feel strangely at home here, and it's been a very lovely visit, and I've enjoyed speaking to students during the day. As presented, I'm going to talk about notions of the Aryan as they pertain to European thought, but also to Indian thought. Curiously, roughly simultaneously, there were speculations about who these Aryans were in India and in Europe. And I'm particularly looking, I'm not looking at those discussions that have to do with calibration and cranial size and things like that, but I was looking at those notions of the Aryan as they pertain or as they are supported by references to Indian, ancient Indian canonical sources. So I will not be looking at those people who do not touch, who do not refer to textualities. I will only be talking about those people who refer to textuality. And then in my final statements, I'll talk about perhaps some recent repercussions of all this. The present is fractured. It consists of competing pasts. By positing the past as a special case of the present, one not only remakes the present, but creates a new past and redefines identity as kin, race, family, through an act of memory. The past possesses sociopolitical instrumentality when perceptions of past history are made relevant to the present. Conflicts concerning the past are, in fact, struggles suggesting the proper shape that the present should take. In such instances, history may be elevated to myth when the needs of the present are read into the past and an image of the past is imposed on the present. History, once transformed into myth, becomes an instrument to construct social forms. It shapes the present through an evocation of the past and specific groups that inhabit it. Today I will discuss how the Aryan past can be studied as a myth. By the term myth, I specifically mean a form of discourse which can be employed in the construction or the deconstruction of society. In particular, this examination focuses on the discourse concerning the Aryan race as a shared myth in 19th century India and in Germany. Myths concerning the Aryans gave historical value to ancient Indian history, contributing to the ideological concerns of India during the colonial and nationalist periods. They also served the political and ideological interests of Europe. The history of India could be appropriated as a means of expressing 19th century European concern with origins. An examination of the Aryan myth thus addresses a fundamental concern of post-colonialist criticism, namely that the West needed to construct the Orient as its other in order to constitute itself and its own subjective position. Finally, we will suggest how Aryan ideology might continue to resonate in current-day identity politics. Since the Aryan arrival in India is associated with the compilation of the Rig Veda, I will focus primarily on how the notion of the Aryan developed through a continued rearticulation of the authority vested in Vedic texts. For Indians and Westerners alike, the Veda functioned as the touchstone for Hindu orthodoxy and understanding of the Aryan world. It served as a point of reference to be regarded as absolutely authoritative, yet it provided a rather peculiar canon, open yet unerring, complete yet subject to reinterpretation. In India, while the Vedas are revered and recognized as omniscient, the texts themselves were weakened, altered, or even lost. Before the 19th century, the Vedas were not used beyond their ritual status as a practical guide. They were invoked rather than rigorously analyzed as communicative texts. In Europe, different hermeneutic issues presented themselves, since the Veda engendered critical discussion in the form of spurious fragments, misattributions, and forgery. When we speak of the reception of the Veda in pre-19th century Europe and India, we are referring to either an absent or a falsely present text. In critical terms, the Veda functioned as an aporia. As the textual reference in the formation of an ideology regarding the Aryan, it thus posed problems from the perspective of canonicity. In what manner was the Veda used to legitimize assertions of faith and law? What were accepted procedures for interpreting it as a canonical text? How did they change over time and place? Was there ever an accepted interpreter whose exegesis was seen as binding even before it was read? We will see how, to a certain extent, the Veda's reception characterized the situation where the devil can quote scripture to his need. A canonical literature arises through the consensus of a group elite and normally serves to stabilize that group. It lends value to the interests and products of that group. A fictive Veda, or the fiction of the Veda, was used to this effect in both the East and the West. Throughout the 19th century, the myth of the Aryan became grounded in idiosyncratic readings and authoritative definitions of what was considered Vedic. This myth was used to disarticulate and rearticulate society, as the following examples demonstrate. Modern Indian readings of Vedic texts revalorized ancient Indian history and contributed to social reform. Perhaps the most radical 19th century reformer was Dayanand Saraswati. In 1875, he founded the Arya Samaj with the belief that modern Indians needed only to return to Aryan values articulated in the Veda in order to effect reform. Since he believed that the Veda possessed all the necessary learning, Dayanand based his entire program on its interpretation. Dayanand's initial task consisted, therefore, of identifying and delimiting a canon of authority. As the only texts composed by God, the Vedas were alone infallible. Other texts depended on them for their respected authority, and if any part of them contradicted the Veda, they should be rejected. Delimiting his canon was therefore not difficult. Making this canon conform to his reform agenda, however, proved to be a more daunting task. The texts upon which Dayanand sought to base his new religion simply did not suit all his needs. The inadequacy of his canon becomes apparent when one compares the first and second editions of his commentary, the Satyarth Prakash. The first thing one notices is that Dayanand often made claims regarding the Aryan past by citing sources that did not even follow the authority he quoted. Frequently, he presented some supposed interpretation of a Vedic passage without even citing any reference. On other occasions, he chose to support his supposedly Vedic readings with citations he actually called from non-Vedic texts, noteworthy for their interpretive flexibility, such as the laws of Manu, the principal Upanishads, and the six schools of philosophy. Dayanand also allowed himself considerable freedom in his treatment of verbs. Claiming that the Veda is timeless, he felt justified in changing verb tense or person. He could transform the past into the present and the specific into the general. The latitude that such tinkering afforded his commentary cannot be overstressed. It virtually liberated what he claimed to be the authoritative reading of an ultimately canonical text from any bonds of textuality. However, Dayanand's most effective strategy for reading the Veda support his argument was to be found in his fanciful etymologies and translations. Creative etymology allowed him to draw some rather baroque conclusions, that the Aryans possessed sophisticated scientific data regarding air filtration, they knew about the telegraph, water purification techniques, and the science of aeronautics. Creative translations also allowed Dynon to reveal the Aryans' historical commitment to social progress. And here I'm going to cite two examples of this process. The Yajurveda text 2010 is literally translated thus: I take my stand on princely power and kingship. Okay, simple phrase. Dynon rendered this passage, I live in a kingdom which is administered righteously and in the country which is awakened due to widespread literacy and morality. Two sentences later in the same passage, the Sanskrit can be translated thus, I stay on welfare, on upper regions and earth, and I recline on sacrifice. To which Dynon offers the following reading. Those who carry on duties of government regarding me as their supreme lord achieve always triumph and progressive prosperity. All government officials thereby should strive to enlighten the people with knowledge and justice and should protect them so that injustice and ignorance may be uprooted. Okay, so you see what he's doing with the translations. Such broad translations enable Dynon to draw his most significant conclusions regarding Aryan religious belief. A free rendering of the term pratima as measure, rather than its standard meaning as idol or image, allowed Dynon to claim that the Veda prohibits image worship. Morphosyntactic switching allowed Dynon to prove the existence of Vedic monotheism. Even though the term deva, or god, has 10 possible meanings and can clearly be made in the plural, Dynon concluded that it cannot suggest a multiplicity of divinities. In this manner, Dynon fudged definitions to deny Hindu polytheism and idolatry, constant themes in his attack on traditional beliefs and practices. In short, Dynon used a shadow Veda, or alternative canon, miscitations, creative etymologies, and mistranslations to present a portrait of an idealized, monotheistic Aryan world devoid of idolatry. In this manner, the Veda became a proto-modernist tool for reform. But it was not merely a question of correcting and manipulating the text to suit his reform agenda. Dynon had to rehabilitate also the reader as well. For Dynon, the loss of Aryanhood and the degradation of values from the Vedic Golden Age was also due to the loss of interpretive skills. As we've seen, he first proposed to revive the glorious Aryan past through the restoration of Vedic textual knowledge. In doing so, he assigned to the Veda an authority which far exceeded its traditional status within orthodoxy. While still the locus of truth and authority, the Veda now became the measure of all knowledge and the only tool whereby the reversal of India's social-cultural decline could be effected. His next task was to rehabilitate the reader. A significant aspect of this reform movement would consist in making scripture available to believers. This meant releasing its interpretation from priestly control. Dynon claimed that since ancient times, the Veda had either been foreclosed or incorrectly read by its Brahmin custodians. Modern Hindus had limited access to the texts and had thus degenerated as a people. Dynon felt that by reconnecting with the Veda, they could reverse this process of racial decay. It was through his various hermeneutic stratagems that he sought to guide them back to the Veda's true meaning and its ideal Weltanschauung. Other reformers would follow Dynon's lead and also seek to reinterpret the Vedic canon in order to assert a true Aryan identity. The next stage in the reform process sought to tie the issues of canonicity and readership to the reformulation of gender. Since identity was text-centered, the Aryanization of the modern Indian male by subsequent reformers centered on reading the Veda as texts legitimating power and control. The retrieval of this Vedic canon and its reinterpretation expressed a will to power over one's own degenerate male self and over the female whose social position threatened that colonized and emasculated self. The valorization of the Veda also expressed a will to identify with those superior qualities that had previously been attributable to the West but could now be situated in the fictive Aryan past. It enabled nationalist reformers to allocate lost Aryan strength to the Indian colonial present. Like Dayanand, Mahadev Govind Ranade sought to retrace the glory of India's Aryan past and revive Hindu society by correcting distortions of Vedic sources through accumulative layers of misreading. If one returned to the old text, he claimed, one would rediscover through textual analysis that the dependent status of women, child marriage, and female seclusion were not authentic Aryan practices. Similarly, prohibitions against widows remarrying, intercaste marriage, and foreign travel were also distortions of the old Aryan standards. Ranade claimed that interpolations had been made on authoritative texts in order to support changes that had been introduced as Aryan society decayed. Ranade believed that reform could take place only if modern Hindus took a stand and defended the letter of the ancient ordinances. An opportunity for such action presented itself in 1870. In Pune, a center of orthodoxy, a meeting was convened to debate the issue of widow remarriage. The orthodox community argued in favor of the prohibition and claimed textual support for their position. To counter their claim, Ranade specifically enumerated Vedic authorities that allowed widow remarriage. He maintained that the orthodox party had cited some general prohibitory texts from inferior law treatises. The gist of Ranade's argument was that the medieval legal theorist Parashara was the guiding legal authority, and he had enumerated the particular cases where remarriage was allowed. The orthodox objection to Parashara hinged upon his use of the Sanskrit term pati, meaning husband or protector. The orthodox camp claimed that in the text, pati did not mean husband, but rather signified protector. What the sages meant, they averred, was that the widow should have another protector. Ranade countered this argument by claiming that such a reading, given its context, was false. In the text, the injunction was immediately followed by other cases where the meaning for pati was clearly husband, and the text referred to anya, or another pati, which would make no sense if the first meaning of pati meant something other than husband. By means of this close reading, Ranade thus rejected the orthodox interpretation of the passage. However, despite Ranade's strong argument and the weak case presented by the orthodox contingent, the council nevertheless voted in favor of maintaining the prohibition against widow remarriage. Although there would be no immediate improvement in the cruel conditions assigned to widows, the movement to reform widow remarriage prohibitions would continue. Ranade next turned his attention to the marriage to the matter of infant marriage. In 1884, the Gujarati reformer Baramji Baranji Malabari published his Notes on Infant Marriage and Enforced Widowhood. The time was particularly propitious for agitation against this abuse, since the Criminal Procedure Bill, amendment known as the Ilbert Bill, had recently sought to place native Indians on equal footing with accused Europeans in criminal proceedings. Malabari took the offensive. He said, if Indians wanted equality in politics, why did they not exercise it in their own homes? Ranade wrote a commentary on Malabari's notes that supported legislation against infant marriage. As in the case of widow remarriage, Ranade's argument was text-centered. He claimed that infant marriage was never included among the pure customs of the Aryans, but rather, like sati and infanticide, reflected degenerate excrescences on the once healthy Aryan society. The tendency to lower the age of consent marked degenerative post-Aryan India. As in the case of widow remarriage, Ranade advised his readers to follow the rule laid down by in Vedic times by the texts themselves and to return to the true and legitimate order. Ranade began his commentary by vouching for the authenticity of his sources. The various law treatises he cited were unanimously in favor of late rather than infant marriage. The majority of the authorities stipulated that the age of 12, or puberty, was the ideal age for females. Ranade argued that only later texts sanctioned girls marrying before the age of 8. Moreover, he claimed that the sources cited by pundits to condone infant marriage were actually obscure law treatises of which complete texts were not preserved. Ranade also rejected the passages from the laws of Manu quoted in favor of infant marriage, claiming it to be a misinterpretation. He felt that here, too, the problem with the orthodox argument in favor of infant marriage was its penchant for lumping all law books together, major and minor, original or later accretions. He claimed that by applying a faulty method of exegesis, the Orthodox camp sought to reconcile divergent and non-authoritative texts by inventing fictions. Ronaday also accused the pundits of twisting and torturing the texts absurdly. He called for Hindus to take the texts as they exist, arrange them in intelligent order, and determine where the balance of authority rested. He personally concluded that the text supported a post-pubescent female marriage. Just as in the argument favoring remarriage for widows, Ronaday's justification for a post-pubescent marriage depended on a close reading of texts and their canonical legitimacy. This strategy of explicating and hierarchizing canonical authority was also adopted by Bal Gangadhar Tilak in the next stage of the Orthodox resistance to infant marriage. As in the case of Ronaday, Tillich's great battle for Arian authenticity revolved around women's rights. After initial skirmishes over female education, Tillich joined the infant marriage debate. Ronaday had condemned the practice of infant marriage and advocated its voluntary prescription. Tillich, the Orthodox firebrand, claimed to approve this measure, but vigorously protested over any official state regulation. He said he was against it, but he wasn't going to let the British lay down the law. The government remained passive until 1890, when the 11-year-old Fulmani Bai died from injuries sustained during sexual intercourse with her considerably older husband. The Legislative Council decided to act, since Fulmani Bai's husband was not liable to any criminal charge. Malabari saw in this tragedy the test case with which to take his cause to London and enlist government support for reform. Tillich's contention was that the English as foreigners had no just jurisdiction over matters of religion, a strategy he applied also to the Parsi Malabari. Moreover, Tillich defended his position by resuscitating the claim that legal treatises from the pure Arian past did not support reform. Tillich positioned law books as the ultimate religious authority and invoking them as male texts written against the female body. He claimed that Fulmani Bai died for having, quote, an unusually dangerous organ. Tillich blamed the girl's death on her being one of those, quote, dangerous freaks of nature. How, he asked, could a husband reasonably be punished because of a, quote, defective female organ, and persecuted, quote, diabolically for doing a harmless act. The final battle in the Age of Consent controversy had begun. In the proceedings of the Council of the Governor General, Orthodox anti-reformers renewed their strategy by alluding to textual support for the custom. Justice Taylong of the Bombay's High Court rearticulated the reformist position that the law treatises in favor of infant marriage actually distorted ancient Arian practice. Finally, the renowned Sanskrit scholar Ramkrishna Gopal Bhandarkar presented the most eloquent defense of reform and the most authoritative challenge to orthodoxy's vague and rhetorical reliance on textuality. Bhandarkar accused Tillich and the Orthodox anti-reformers of enlisting and then distorting texts to support ideological projects. Bhandarkar then quoted verbatim references to claim that Hindu religious law only allowed consummation 3 years after puberty because medical science felt the female could not give birth to a healthy child before 16 years of age. Tillich's bluff had been called. The Brahmin habit of fuzzy citations of purportedly authoritative texts, a tradition so artfully exploited by Dayanand and manipulated by Tillich, was unmasked by an unimpeachable Sanskrit authority. Either one respected the letter of the text or one left one's references vague. One could no longer misquote the canon and get away with it. In the preceding discussion, we've examined in detail several Indian nationalist configurations of the Arian myth. What is particularly striking about these stagings of the past is their literary aspect, specifically their modernism. In reading Swami Dayanand, Ranade, and Tillich, one is reminded of certain short stories by Borges, where history is presented as inevitably limited and parochial in focus. Facts are only interpreted according to the ideology of the time, just as memory is activated by conventional scholarly wisdom. History and memory are potentially radically different phenomena than they appear to be. What is remembered or recorded is paltry in comparison to what actually took place. Great races have existed but have been lost or forgotten. Outside recorded history, there was once a golden age with mythic forebears who accomplished astounding feats. The central insight here is that myth holds greater truth value than history. As opposed to history, myth absorbs contradictions into its own system. Myth is permitted to ignore details since it contains the true spirit of the past, its essential legacy. These various Indian attempts to recuperate the Aryan past show us how truth is ever elusive and open to reconfiguration. The truth regarding the Aryans was less to be found in their literature than in what this literature no longer was able to express. Truth was not to be discovered in words, but rather in the lacunae, the message that had been lost through decay, inaccessibility, and the loss of the ability to read correctly. These discussions on Aryanhood were either system-maintaining or counter-systemic. The system in question was the caste system, and specifically the role of Brahmins as the disseminators of the Veda, its legitimate readers and users or abusers of secular power. Either Brahmin access to the canon and their unique right to interpret it alone should be jealously guarded, or the text should be wrested away from their custodians. The larger question addressed here is central to all critical endeavors. Who should read or interpret texts of authority, and who is the legitimate reader of any canon? In the second half of my talk, I'd like to briefly explore these questions as they pertain to German 19th century readings of the Veda. Contemporaneously with Indian flights of scholarly imagination within the domains of linguistics and textual analysis, a myth of origin in the Aryan past was taking form in the West. Friedrich Max Müller's publication of the Rig Veda Samhita, and this publication took place between 1849 and 1874, provided the source material for this discourse. Müller's edition was noteworthy for many reasons, not the least of which was his inclusion of Sayana's commentary in his edition. The inclusion of this medieval Sanskrit commentary generated a debate concerning the feasibility and accessibility of reading and interpreting the Veda. Could the Veda be read? And ideally, by whom? Specifically, it raised the issue of the Europeans' relation to the Aryan past. Rudolf von Roth, who produced one of the first scholarly works on the Veda, disparaged the need for the use of native commentaries. He noted that, quote, a conscientious European interpreter, end of quote, could understand Indian mythology far better, being in a position to search out the sense which the poets themselves have put into their hymns and utterances. Such a statement suggests just to what extent the use or rejection of Sayana's commentary reflected not only issues of translation technique, but more interestingly, political concerns. German discourse on the Aryans articulated in the reception of the Veda engendered discussions on race and ethnicity. It exhibited a European attempt to appropriate and distanciate Indian scripture from anything Indian. The claim, championed particularly by Roth, was that the conscientious Anglo-Saxon understood the Veda better than Sayana. This presupposed a common and originary cultural heritage with the Aryans. The tradition was lost to Indians in the post-Vedic period, but not to the Anglo-Saxon, who, no matter how far removed from the tradition, was never far removed from its vision. The German Romantics had set the stage for European readers to believe that linguistics would open doors to knowledge that would remain closed to Indians. Until Müller's edition, quote, our own history was only gleaned through guesswork and endless baseless speculation. Now it was deemed available through Vedic references. Müller rhapsodized that, quote, the fathers of the Aryan race, the fathers of our own race, gathered together in the great temple of nature, like brothers of the same house, looking up in adoration to the sky as the emblem of what they yearned for, a father and a god, end of quote. The American Sanskritist W.D. Whitney, not one to dismiss Müller's flights of poetic fancy, mocks such passages where Müller seems to depict the Aryans, quote, this is what Whitney says, perched for a couple thousands of years on some exalted post of observation, watching the successive departure from their ancient home of the various European tribes, end of quote. Whitney then questions whether Mueller wrote these descriptions under the influence of paintings such as the Kaulbach Tableau in Berlin, depicting people at the foot of a ruined Tower of Babel. While not a kind assessment, Whitney touches upon a significant point. Max Mueller read the Veda in conformity with Romantic ideological concerns. It is to be noted that the Romantics held that the simplicity of religious dogmas defined the original state of man and its corollaries that monotheism was anterior to polytheism and primitive revelation had progressively degenerated. Once a people has unfolded its spirit to its full expression from the Romantic point of view, it has fulfilled its role in history and only repetition, stagnation, and decay would follow. Mueller's conclusions recapitulated this Romantic thesis when he envisioned his task, quote, to discover the first germs of the language, religion, and mythology of, quote, our forefathers. The Aryan world is exemplified in the Veda, presented the sharp edges of primitive thought, the delicate features of a young language, the fresh hue of unconscious poetry, end of quote. In Mueller's abundant commentary on the Veda, he confirmed the Romantic hypotheses regarding the degeneration of primitive monotheism into polytheism and the view of history as an unfolding expression of the spirit of a people followed by degeneration and stagnation. These themes would become significant in the characterization of Indian civilization, appearing in the general writings of philosophers like Hegel, Marx, and Spengler. Mueller's enthusiastic public relations work on behalf of the Vedic Aryans effected their entree into the public domain. A new generation of, quote, philosophers who were working outside an institutional framework developed popular theories regarding the Aryans that would have serious repercussions. Arthur de Gobineau, for example, was particularly interested in perceived Aryan notions of racial decline. From his misreading of the Veda, Gobineau proposed that a nation's survival was tied to the purity of its racial composition. Gobineau created a racial fiction regarding the European present based on notions of monarchy and aristocracy. Aryan India offered Gobineau a propitious model, a philosophy of the good old times, when the social classes were sharply divided. The nobles played the role of the creators, the bearers of the sacred fire of spiritual progress. They opposed the defilers of culture, the quintessential forces of decadence. The Aryans of German Vedic scholarship, and notably Christian Lassen's Indische Altertumskunde, who tussled among themselves, became Gobineau's valiant and audacious Aryans who withstood the assault upon their way of life that was waged by the indigenous tribes they encountered. Their virtue was the heroism of the combatant that Gobineau recognized in his own day only among the French aristocracy. The poison of racial mixing, however, had degraded the Indian Aryan, just as it will eventually kill humanity as a whole. Gobineau related his version of the Aryan saga as a warning to the Germans, whom he viewed as the last whites, those who had evolved the most and whose duty it had become to save humanity. If the Germans fail, no other nation would be available. They provided the last possibility for culture. When the Germans fall, Gobineau opined, so too would the world. Gobineau concluded L'essai sur l'inégalité des races humaines, the essay on the inequality of the human races, with the warning that destiny's greedy hands were already upon us in the form of Asian, Mongolian, and Slavic hordes. By charting the twilight of the Aryans, the Aryer Dämmerung, Gobineau not only heralded the end of the world, but also the twilight of the gods. He concluded that since Vedic scripture had not been able to alter the Indians' fate, blood poisoning was the destiny of all people. Nothing, in his estimation, could prevent the inevitable destruction of race. The Germans, who he identified as modern Aryans, would themselves also eventually fall. The racial theorist Eustace Stuart Chamberlain further developed Gobineau's doctrines. Chamberlain read the Veda to construct an idealized portrait of the Aryan world that stood in sharp contrast to that of the Jew. Where exactly in the Sanskrit text Chamberlain culled his information is left vague. We only learn that the Veda shows the Aryan gods to be bright, true, and friendly. Unlike the Jews, the Aryans were without malice, perfidy, or cruelty. They had a feeling of duty and responsibility. The Vedas afforded them the freedom of thought. They did not possess the Jews', quote, violence and fanaticism. In fact, Chamberlain claimed the Jews stole their concept of monotheism from the Aryans. just as they pilfered their own other great achievements from foreigners. The Aryans were thinkers, poets, and creators. They discovered the great truth expressed in the Rig Veda, that one must seek the core of nature within the heart. This truth never dawned on the Jews because of their lack of will. From an unspecified reading of the Veda, Chamberlain claimed to have constructed a history of the Aryan people that allowed him to argue that the Jew was a purveyor of materialism, intolerance, and social dissolution. They were, quote, men of chaos, who disfigured what they stole from the Aryans and handed down metaphysical distortions in the form of Christianity. Chamberlain implored Germans to recapture their Aryan heritage from the alien grasp of the Jew and the Semitized church. He saw the possibility of reversing racial degeneration through breeding. In this respect, Chamberlain was like Nietzsche and Fichte, whose indebtedness to Sanskrit scripture I've examined elsewhere. Romantic belief in an Aryan, organic, and sacred community also found expression in the work of the National Socialist ideologue Alfred Rosenberg. Borrowing from Nietzsche's reading of Indian law, Rosenberg emphasized the supposed Aryan glorification of breeding. From Gobineau, Rosenberg borrowed the concept of history as racial history, the identification of the Aryan with the German, and the emphasis on Aryan bastardization. In all these authors, the return to the Aryan ideal was, as with the Indian reformers we have examined, supposedly based on the authority of Aryan texts. This documentation was Aryan in the loosest sense of the term, consisting of secondhand Vedic sources, Indological scholarship, and translation from other Sanskrit texts, regardless of their status or antiquity. While you may, until tonight, not have been fully versed in how Indians constructed an Aryan past to foster nationalism, we are all too knowledgeable of how the Aryan myth was ultimately deployed in Germany. Sanskrit scripture was co-opted and misread to provide essential information concerning the European past. It promised to reveal the state of civilization which was closest to the supposed common ancestors of all Indo-German peoples. Specifically, certain Germans came to believe that the study of the Vedic mythology would elucidate the history and the fate of their own pure and cultivated Aryan ancestors. The discovery that there existed in India a tradition older, or at least as old, as the biblical tradition was regarded in the West as an event of the first magnitude, only to be compared in its consequences to the rediscovery of classical antiquity in the Renaissance. Through the study of India's past, it was hoped that scholars could reconstruct the history of mankind's past and origin, the development of religions and philosophies. By giving the Vedic Aryans a place in universal history, an overt displacement of the Jews was effected. Much of the discourse concerning the Veda effectively resulted in assigning the Jews a subaltern role in history. This ideology of the Veda participated in the formation of a new mythology of the past. The myth of the Aryan, both in India and in the West, was fueled by irrational impulses growing out of anxiety regarding questions of national identity and mission. Themes operant in the discourse on the Veda found their way into these new mythologies. In Germany, we find the displacement of the Jews from a central position on the stage of history, and in India, a scriptural basis for the suppression of women and justification of caste exclusions. In both the East and the West, the Aryan myth provided theories regarding the degeneration of peoples and religions. Finally, it offered an idealized portrait of imaginary ancestors and their fictitious descendants. The thesis of this paper today summarizes a work that I published in my book, Aryans, Jews, and Brahmins, from almost a decade ago. And in the short time that remains, I'd like to extend this discussion further by comparing the myth of the Aryan in the East and the West to developments I've seen in identity politics in American academia. So I'm jumping way out of the theme. I've talked about the East and the West and the Aryan myth, and now I'm going to talk about ideas of perhaps Aryanhood as we're seeing it in the institutionalization of India in American academia. A few years ago, the librettist for the Broadway show Bombay Dreams was quoted as saying, "Brown is the new black." William Sapphire noted in the New York Times that with this comment, Meera Syal was not making a fashion statement. She was, in fact, alluding rather to the popularity of South Asians in the West and the perception that the culture of people with brown skin from South Asia was now hotter than that of the culture of black-skinned people in the estimation of certain whites. In a big leap of imagination, I'd like to question whether the valorization of Indians in American academia betokens yet another valorization of the Aryan at the expense of a subject group. Or as Vijay Prashad has put it succinctly, American institutions use Indians as a weapon against Black America. Prashad evokes W.E.B. Du Bois's question to the blacks, how does it feel to be a problem? And asks his fellow Indian Americans, how does it feel to be a solution? In my most recent book, which is titled Otherwise Occupied, I've argued that the theory and pedagogy of postcolonialism have been devised less out of a desire for inclusion and more as a concerted attempt to marginalize traditional minorities in American academia. The underlying premise of my argument is that in both the U.S. and India, affirmative action has hit everyone hard. Across both America and India, there's a deep feeling that ground has been lost by those segments of the population who are used to garnering the advantages of privileged status within their respective societies. Whites in America and high castes in India cannot expect doors to open as easily as in the days prior to affirmative action, and the Indian equivalent of affirmative action, which is the Mandal Commission report on compensating discrimination. In response, Americans self-identify themselves as minorities. In India, upper caste Indians also minoritize themselves by paying an untouchable family to adopt them temporarily so they can gain university entrance under a quota system. In the U.S., diasporic Indians construct the minority status of ersatz African Americans. I'm primarily interested here in the latter case, and especially in how the notion of race is institutionalized in the American academic setting. The diasporic Indian's ability to play the race card stems in part from the complexity of Indian constructions of race and color and the nature of educated Indian immigration to the U.S. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's worth noting that beginning in 1950, Indians were categorized as, quote, other white, and not separately counted in the census. In 1975, however, they lobbied for and won minority status as non-white Caucasians. As Caucasian hyphenated Asian people of color, they currently qualify for minority hiring, even if everything about them betokens privilege. Upper caste Indians have long used notions of purity of blood and Caucasian features to exercise power over the majority of the Indian population who have been dubbed the non-Aryan untouchables. This race ideology can be traced back to readings of the Rig Veda. As Harold Isaacs put it rather bluntly in the 70s, those Indians who see themselves as descendants of the Aryans think of themselves as more white than whites. A belief in their intrinsic whiteness as Aryans has never disappeared from their own consciousness. What changed, however, was their greater understanding of American racism. Indian immigrants to the U.S. gradually came to recognize the benefits to be accrued through minority status and sought to position themselves for gain of the resources available to America's historically oppressed minorities. As we've seen in my survey today of 19th century Indian ideation of the Aryan, upper caste Hindus have historically distinguished themselves from their other in terms of their high spirituality and civilization. They have now exported this racial ideology to America. It is a self-image that allows Indian Americans as white minorities to position themselves in such a way that they become as worthy, if not more worthy, of special dispensation than traditional American minorities. As Prashad has noted, this is an attractive position for a migrant in search of some accommodation in a racist polity. In terms of education, class, economic status, and race consciousness, Indian Americans are not really so different from white academics. When their concept of self-worth encounters the unconscious or semi-conscious need of white academics to identify with victims of oppression, we have a highly effective meeting of minds where Indian diasporic politics and American institutional agendas collide. There are at least two political agendas here at work. On the Indian front, Diasporic cultural groups maintain strong ties to Indian political parties, especially the major vehicles of the Hindu fundamentalist right, such as the Vishva Hindu Parishad, the VHP, and the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, which champions Hindutva, or syndicated Brahmanical Hinduism, as the neglected Aryan culture of Hindu Americans. This ideology has consciously entered into the multicultural space opened up in liberal academia by particularly promoting the neglected virtues of an ancient civilization. On the American side, commodifying India in this manner serves concrete developmental needs. Universities have suffered considerable downsizing in recent years. With the loss of public funding, state and private institutions have had to target special interest groups in order to fund new initiatives. Diasporic political groups have become increasingly instrumental in such development projects. Indian Americans, who, by the way, comprise the richest immigrant demographic group in the entire history of the United States, present tremendous economic potential, as evinced by recent Indian-based endowments of chairs in major public and private universities. Institutions have become quite adept at catering to, or some might even say pandering to, such groups. If a vested interest group funds a program, one can be sure that a politically acceptable representation of that nation, its people, and its cultural products is packaged. Appeals to cultural nationalism are thus implicit in institutional development efforts. Since universities are recruiting Indian American students in ever-increasing numbers, it's only logical that they would solicit courses focusing on their communities and concerns. Ideally, these courses would not challenge religious or communalist sympathies. The India, then, that is taught in the U.S. today is Aryan, that is, classical and Sanskritic. Virtually no programs have been recently funded in non-Indo-European or Dravidian Southern studies. There has been a radical downsizing in the study of Indian minority religions, such as Buddhism, Jainism, Zoroastrianism, or Sikhism. Post-colonial studies, that is, courses that focus on the victimization of a people under colonial rule, do not threaten a diaspora community's sense of its identity and the idealized view of the homeland. They thus dovetail very nicely with university marketing concerns. Moreover, recruitment in these programs ideally suit institutional mandates for diversity in hiring. While Black and women's studies are usually populated with Blacks and women, post-colonial studies need not be peopled by the oppressed of the world's post-colonial regions. In fact, post-colonial studies in general can be almost exclusively populated with caste and racial elites possessing a deep sense of self-worth and further legitimized by an Ivy League or Oxbridge education. Who, as Deepika Bahri has claimed, they stand at the ready to step in the name of affirmative hiring. In the past, universities have occluded low numbers in diversity by establishing various ethnic studies programs and peopling them with underrepresented ethnics. Granted, it was not an ideal situation. In fact, it was a balkanization of ethnics into fields for which they were deemed biologically and culturally suited. Ethnics could enter the ivory tower only if they were willing to study themselves. It was, in fact, a ridiculous system. I personally remember far too many interviews where I was asked if I did Spanish rather than Sanskrit or specialized in liberation theology only because the interviewer could not pronounce my surname. Minorities were thus neutralized and contained in such placements. Now, with multiculturalism and post-colonialism, universities can adjust minority numbers without even hiring minorities. In other words, a case can be made that theories of the margin offer the rationale and their practitioners provide the personnel to undermine affirmative action in American institutions today. To quote Ejaz Ahmad, under the guise of studying colonialisms of the past, we can facilitate imperialisms of the present. This does not mean that there is an imminent pogrom in American academia against ethnic minorities, but it does indicate that the expectation of privilege based on historic and mythic conceptions of superiority are still in play. This should not surprise us given the success immigrant elites have experienced in their countries of origin, manipulating bureaucracies and legal systems. What is unique is how well the presentation of self evinced by these elites fits the needs and prejudices of academic bureaucracy in America. By promoting tolerance of a showcase of diverse ethnic practices, Postcolonial theory, in fact, enables an academic elite to displace, diffuse, and thus intensify class, gender, and racial contradictions. In the race politics of American academe and the positioning of the postcolonial critic as the spokesperson for alterity, we can even detect the resurfacing of the Aryan myth in such a culturalist abuse of ethnicity that serves to mask hegemonic domination under the pretext of pluralist tolerance. Thank you. So,
thank you very much. I think we have now time to open up for questions. And can you all hear me okay? Or are you just going to have a mic?
You're good.
Okay? Okay.
I threw a lot of stuff at you today. Yes?
I confess a lot of ignorance about Indian texts and know very little about it. So, I would like to have you give a few moments to explaining what the Veda is,
okay,
since it was so central.
These are the most ancient texts. There are a series of four Vedas. They're basically ritualistic texts. There are sacrificial Vedas. There are the Rig Veda, which is basically the thing that they love so much, is virtually an incomprehensible text. It's very difficult to read. It's very difficult to interpret. They're mystical poems about the nature of the gods, about the nature of the universe, but they also set out an ideology of sacrifice, which was very important to Vedism, which was the religion preceding Hinduism. The justification for caste is found in the Rig Veda, in the taking apart of a primordial man, with the Brahmin being the head, the arms being the warrior caste, the body being the merchants, the people, and the underparts being the untouchables. So caste is justified by the Vedas. The Vedas are the earliest texts. They're in a Vedic Sanskrit. And after the Vedas, then we have the more Hindu texts, such as the Upanishads, the law books, the books of philosophy and everything. But when you're going back to a Bible, I don't want to say this because you don't want to say the Bhagavad Gita, the Bible of Hinduism, but when you're talking about the Ur text, when you're talking about the original text, and also the most difficult to read and the most mystical texts, you go back to this Veda. The reason it wasn't played with until the 19th century is it's damn difficult to decipher. And because only the priests have access to the Sanskrit and have access to the texts, imagine a Bible that can only be read by the priests. So it was a text that was inaccessible to the people, and the priests had control of it, and the priests could say, it's written in the Veda. So there's a joke that that Dayanand fellow said if you lose your cow, look for it in the Veda, because everything is found in the Veda. And then, so these priests basically went on for hundreds and hundreds of years of saying, this is justified, we can do this, because it's in the Veda. So it was like an authoritative text that was evoked and never read, because no one had access to it. So finally, in the 19th century, you had some Indians and you had Max Müller saying, let's get this Veda together, let's come up with an edition. And once we get the text, then let's start reading it. And let's start translating it so we can give it back to the people. There was the notion that the Hindus realized that there were incursions of Westerners who were, you know, converting. And they needed a book religion. They needed a book to counter the Bible. So on the part of the Indians, they wanted to get that Veda out there so they could have a book religion to confront all the Protestants and the... Well, Catholics were there earlier, but they needed a book to fight with. And so that's why the Veda became important. But what I was interested in is how everyone played with, as a literature person, how everyone played with this text and how all this stuff was done from this crazy readings, miscitation, playing around with it, and going back to this text that no one really had access to, but justifying their behavior with the authority of an absent, the book was titled The Authority of an Absent Text. How you can use an absent text to build a system. Does that explain things?
Yeah. How far back do the Vedas go?
Thousands. We're going thousands of years. We're going way back. We're going 800 BC. They don't really know. This notion of history is very vague. When you teach it, I say it's either between 1,000 and 500. You know, everything's a 500-year period that you cite. It's nice teaching because the students are never asked on tests when was this book published. You can give any day and get the right answer.
Just curious, I don't know anything about Sanskrit, but how broad or vague can the translations themselves be?
Really vague. Any given word has 10, 12 different meanings. I mean, you look up a word, and that's how they could do something like the word pratima, which really means idol. It means image. It means graven image. But he said, no, let's use this definition, and that way we can say that we don't believe in idolatry. So it's such a clever poetry that lines of poetry are written to be read in 5 different ways, depending on which definition you choose from the dictionary. So they play with the incredible flexibility of the vocabulary.
Okay.
It's very flexible. It's very difficult. It can be manipulated very easily. But they weren't manipulating Vedic texts. They were manipulating all these other texts, which was curious.
Okay.
But it's a poetry. It's a language that is very artful that way, and played with. Puns are tremendous. They love to pun because there are so many different definitions for words. Yeah.
So you could almost say that these texts were originally designed to be played with, to be misinterpreted.
The Rig Veda. No, the other Vedas are basic sacrificial things. You got a fire. You're setting up a horse sacrifice. You're going to say this incantation over this. You're going to do this. Those things are very simple. But the Rig Veda is speculative mysticism. I always teach it in terms of, if you've ever read any mystical writings, that's what you got. Mystical writings in a language where there are 10 definitions for every word. And also the funny thing about Sanskrit is that the words are not separated. So they're all elided together. So even if you cut the words in different ways, they can have different meaning. So in the Rig Veda, you talk about the untouchables, and you talk about the enemies of the Vedic areas, and you call them anas. Anas can either mean anas or an-as. If you translate it as an-as, it means they don't speak Sanskrit. An-as, without speech. Barbarians, like our word that if you babble, you're a barbarian, you don't speak Greek. If you translate it as anas, it means without a nose, meaning flat-nosed, meaning aboriginal, meaning racially different, meaning Dravidian. So these things are played with. But I would term it as, it's not easy to read mysticism. Pick up Meister Eckhart, pick up St. John of the Cross, make it a little more difficult, and that's what you have in the Rig Veda. Yeah?
On the affirmative action part of your speech, is there any clear-cut solution to that type of situation?
Yeah, well, that's the speculative part. That part, I was thinking of talking to you. I realized that I was invited to talk about the Aryans. I was very interested in this. But I had this sort of revelation that since I've done this Aryan book, I have gone on and talked about identity politics in this recent book. And that comes out of this shock that I have. You know, 30 years ago or so, or more than 30 years ago, I don't even want to say, in a small upstate New York girls' college, I might have discovered the existence of India, and I wanted to study India. In a college of 2,000 people, in a girls' college in upstate New York, 2,000 people, I could study India in 7 different departments. Someone in geography, someone in anthropology, someone in classics might even teach me Sanskrit. Art history, I guess there are a couple of more. I could religion, political science. Fast forward to 2002, University of Georgia, with an incredible Indian demographic. Granted, it might have something to do with the University of Georgia, but India exists in an English department. And I said to myself, how did this happen? How did this possibly happen? In this age of globalization, where we're taking the others so seriously, where we're supposedly engaging in others, how is it now that we're only engaging in India, in English translation, in an English department? How has this happened? And then I started thinking, what's the institutional game behind this? And It was in thinking along these lines and in questioning the packaging of India, that this packaging that India is no longer India, but India is a couple of diasporic writers of Indian descent living in America writing in the English language, which is great. It's great. Indian American fiction is wonderful. I love it. I teach it. But it's very curious that we're doing the other on the cheap. That was my initial impression, that something sneaky is happening. I'm a suspicious person, that something was going on. That there is, in all this lip service we're paying to the other, somehow the other as it's appearing is very watered down, very pablum, and very washed out. And that started this whole discussion, and then I was basically looking at what's happened in 30 years in terms of minority hiring. Just the question that if you had, you know, do you now not need to have a traditional minority hired as a chemist if you can fulfill your minority quota by having non-traditional minorities or recent immigrants who have not suffered discrimination in America, and certainly not for generations, take the role of the historical minority or this historically underrepresented? And that's what seemed to be happening. And then there was this discussions of identity that I heard over the years, where people would talk about their status, and their discussions or their self-presentation in academia was radically different from sometimes what the reality of their status was. I started looking at the notion of the intellectual exile. I thought that was a fascinating idea, Edward Said's notion of the intellectual exile. Does someone who chooses to come to graduate school in America become an exile? Is that intellectual exile on a part with someone who flees a totalitarian regime? Can we talk about a voluntary exile in the same way as some voluntary exiles do, some voluntary immigrants do, as exiles? Does that also water down the pain of exile? So this is how I was interested in these topics. So I came to that. So I thought I would, as I said, you're a bit of a trial case here, because I was asked to talk about the Aryans, and I'm still very interested in this. But my work has developed, and I hadn't thought about it. I hadn't thought about that book being tied to this recent book, and it was only in this invitation that I said, wait a minute, I am really talking about identity issues. I am talking about mythological constructions of self. And let's face it, there is this problem in the humanities, and there's this problem in literature, in that their literature has, to a certain degree, become the study of identity politics. And it has come to the fact that in many cases we're not looking at texts anymore, but we're looking at the critic's experience of the text, and the art object is not in front of us anymore, but the critic becomes the text. And in literary studies, I mean, we see that all the time. It's sort of scary. I like old textualities. I don't like to hear about academics talking about themselves in lieu of art. Yeah.
Do you know what the or whether there was any Indian involvement in this categorization?
There was major lobbying.
And one more question. Could you guess, or do you know, whether it had any connection to Japanese apparent ability to become honorary Aryans during the Third Reich?
It's actually an interesting chapter in how there was this great desire. I mean, we're going back to we start in the 20s. There is this great desire to come and assert a whiteness in America. And then, at a certain point in the 70s, the immigration really began in the 70s, and it's a unique situation that no other ethnic group have we ever had 100% professional immigration. Usually, it has been the downtrodden, the poor, the uneducated, the unskilled, but in this case, we had primarily highly educated people. So that was a unique situation. The other unique situation is Indian Americans are in the history of immigration, the richest immigrant population ever. That was noticed by the government. And And it was also noticed by the Indians. And in the 70s, there was a considerable lobbying in Washington. And the history can be found. I think Thomas Sowell does a thing of that. And there are a number of other scholars that you can find that. He goes through the entire history. But it's actually fascinating. I was very interested in the notion that in India now, there is this backlash against affirmative action, that you actually have high caste people who are paying off untouchables for their untouchable name for a semester or two to gain entrance. And so you have now this, there's always, in East and West, there is this play with affirmative action. People have got to get around affirmative action one way or the other. It's deemed something that is an abomination that has to be, you have to work the system. But it's not tied at all to the Japanese and the fact that historically, this is not really starting until the 70s with that major influx of immigration.
This isn't tied in any way to sort of racism towards Indians first, that then could, and then a sort of...
Initially in the 20s, there was a case where someone's whiteness went to the Supreme Court. And that was the early case that everything since then has been mitigating against. But it was a very concerted effort. And, you know, a very intelligent effort on the part of the Indians to recuperate, to be both white and minority. Further questions?
Over here.
Ah, yes.
Is there a confusion between the Aryan racial ideology and the caste system in your research? Are those two separate concepts being confused?
Well, caste is justified in the Rig Veda. Caste has been outlawed since independence. Caste continues to exist. Caste is very resilient. The problem with race and caste, the anthropologists tell you, is the word for caste is varna, which also means color. So there was this thought initially by Westerners when they came to India and were looking at caste, that this was something that was tied to color. Yes, it is tied to color. No, it isn't tied to color. So that has been and continues to be a confusion.
In United States academia, is this an issue or?
No, because most people are high caste people who emigrate. Poor people don't have the wherewithal to emigrate. But there are instances. I mean, there are notable instances. The Indian Constitution was written by an untouchable who, because his father was in the British Army, was able to become one of 2% in his caste that learned how to read, and was sent off and became a barrister, and. He came to America in the teens and got a PhD at a fellow by the name of Ambedkar, PhD in sociology and law, and then went back and was called upon to write the Indian Constitution. So we do have instances, but those are real exceptions. He's also the person that did the mass conversion of all untouchables to Buddhism in 1948, because he said he was born a Hindu, he wasn't going to die a Hindu. Caste is outlawed. Caste exists. And that's actually why the Catholics gave up in India. The missionaries, Francis Xavier, and they gave up because caste was too intractable. Even when they converted people, even converted to Catholicism, Indians still held to their caste prejudice. They could not deal with the fact that this priest might be an untouchable. And so they never... Francis Xavier says, I've converted hundreds of thousands of untouchables, not one Brahmin, and it's not going to work. And that's why they went to Japan. They just couldn't deal, the Franciscans and the Jesuits couldn't deal ultimately with caste. They just realized it was not something they could deal with. Yeah?
With the identity felt by the elite in India and with the National Socialist Movement in Germany, could it be said that this Aryan identity is also felt by North Ireland Protestants, either being English Protestants or, even though the Scots who settled were essentially Celtic, still staunch Calvinists? is there some sort of identity connection?
That's a hard one to that's a hard one for me to ask because I'm so ignorant of that of the situation. But it is north and south. there is a notion of who are the original inhabitants and who are the interlopers. Those issues seem to be operative. The religious thing is not an issue because these are all Hindus, supposedly Hindus. I mean, that was the problem with Gandhi, is he wanted to keep those untouchables Hindus as a voting block. That's why he loved the untouchables so much. He didn't want them to become Muslims. So I really can't talk about the British-Irish situation, but I can't answer that. But it's interesting. I mean, it might be something to look into. But I'm ignorant of that. Anything else? Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.